Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Neurology. In this podcast, Professor Tobias Derfus, a leading expert in the treatment of multiple sclerosis, reviews the cellular model of disease in multiple sclerosis and how pathophysiology can offer novel therapeutic targets. He outlines the role of immune cells in driving multiple sclerosis pathogenesis, explains how the pathobiology of the disease has driven the development of disease-modifying therapies, and reviews the mechanism of action and clinical trial landscape for Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Healthcare Business of Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello and welcome to this educational program. My name is Tobias Derfus. I'm professor of neurology at the University Hospital Basel. I'm delighted to welcome you to this education about pathophysiology of multiple sclerosis and the development of new therapies. As you all know, multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease of the central nervous system. However, the immune response is triggered and initiated in the periphery, in lymphoid organs, at least as we see it in animal models. B cells can capture their autoantigen in peripheral tissues or get it presented by dendritic cells in lymphoid organs. They take up the antigen, chop it into little pieces, and present the peptides on HLA class 2. When they encounter a T cell with the same specificity, the T cell can recognize the peptide in HLA context via the TCR, and the T cell gets activated. Upon activation, CD40 ligand is expressed by the T cell, and this binds to the CD40 receptor on B cells. This is an important interaction because it prevents the death of the activated B cell. Besides this CD40 ligand signaling, T cells also produce a lot of pro-inflammatory cytokines like interferon gamma and IL-21 that lead to proliferation and maturation of the B cells. You can see another two important aspects on this slide. So not all the T and B cells are really autoreactive and pro-inflammatory. Only the ones that express the transcription factors TBET, both in the T cell and in the B cell. And this is characterized by the production of certain cytokines. Another important aspect is that the T regulatory cells that are normally there to reduce the immune response, and that the function of this Treg is reduced in MS patients, and also the number of Treg is reduced. And therefore, the autoimmune reaction can really take place. Once the T cells and B cells are activated, they can exit the lymph node, go to the bloodstream, and search for the antigen. They can go, of course, everywhere in the body, but if they go through the brain, they find there the blood-brain barrier that is normally closed for immune cells. That's one part of the immune privilege of the brain that T and B cells cannot easily enter into the CNS. There's a tight junction that connects the endothelial cells and prevents the migration of immune cells from the blood into the brain. You also have to imagine that the blood cells run fast through the vessels, and they really have to get an anchor to stop and roll, and then finally migrate through the blood-brain barrier. And therefore, they need certain molecules. An important first step for tethering is the expression of selectines on the endothelial cells and PSGL1 on the immune cells. So these two factors can interact, and then the T and the B cells can adhere to the endothelial cells. The next step is that they roll along the endothelial cells, and this process is nicely shown both by in vitro data, but also nice in vivo imaging data with two photon microscopy by the group from Alexander Flügel in Göttingen. Two important factors that then help to adhere the immune cells to the endothelial cells are VLA4 and LFA1. They bind to the VCAM1 and ICAM1 that are expressed by endothelial cells. So after tethering, rolling, and adhering, they finally can migrate through the endothelium. And interestingly, they can not only migrate between cells, so in a paracellular way, but also directly through endothelial cells into the brain. And then they are located in perivascular cuffs where they need reactivation, which I'll show you later on. A very new and exciting development is that maybe the blood-brain barrier of MS patients is different compared to control patients. We all know that there are genetic polymorphisms that mainly target the immune system in MS. So the group from Britta Engelhardt and Renaud Dupaquier made an in vitro model of blood-brain barrier using induced pluripotent stem cells from MS patients, but also from controls. And then they looked at the barrier function of these cells. And they could show that blood-brain barrier cells that have been derived from iPSC cells from MS patients, they showed an impaired junctional integrity and an inflammatory phenotype, really indicating that the blood-brain barrier might per se be different and more pro-inflammatory and thereby allow the immune cells to get more ready access to the brain. So I told you the immune cells go through the blood-brain barrier and then they accumulate in perivascular cuffs. So that's the region between the endothelium and the basement membrane. And there, these immune cells need to get reactivated. So the T cells have to see again their antigen. This can happen again, like I showed you in the lymph node, with the interaction with T and B cells. So the B cells present their peptide, the T cells recognize it via the T cell receptor and get activated, but also other antigen-expressing cells, presenting cells, can activate the T cells. And then, after this activation, the T cells migrate further into the brain tissue. But not only the T cells go into the brain, also the B cells migrate through the blood-brain barrier into the CSF and the CNS of MS patients. And there, they locally produce immunoglobulins, namely IgG1, IgG3, but also IgM and IgA isotypes. This is, of course, a known phenomenon, and we use it for diagnostics of MS as an intrathecal immunoglobulin production or the famous oligoclonal bands. So far, we don't know which antigen these antibodies recognize, but we know that the IgM concentration in CSF correlates with disease activity and with spinal cord lesions. And really novel data from ECTRIMS last year showed that the complement activation in the CSF is correlated with the IgM concentration, really indicating that the antibodies in the CSF and brain recognize the target antigen, which then leads to complement activation, and this further speeds up the inflammation in the CNS. So altogether, you have an immune reaction that brings in different immune cells, T cells and B cells, but of course also the resident innate immune cells, the microglia, are activated. And also innate immune cells from the periphery, macrophages, infiltrate into the brain. And this is caused by the chemokine and cytokine productions of the infiltrating CD4 and B cells. And together, they then lead to an inflammation in the brain by production of different cytokines, by a direct attack of CD8 T cells against the neurons, by reactive oxygen species produced by macrophages, by antibodies that bind to oligodendrocytes, neurons, astrocytes, and so on, and activate complement. So in the end, the cascade is very complex, so there's a plethora of different mechanisms that could lead to a destruction of the neurons and the oligodendrocytes. Unfortunately, so far, we don't know the real antigen that initiates this response, in contrast to other autoimmune diseases like neuromyelitis optica, where we know that an aquaporin 4 antibody response leads to a destruction of astrocytes and then later on demyelination. We don't know the real antigen in multiple sclerosis. We believe that the antibodies, as I said before, recognize really something, as well as the T cell receptors of CD8 and CD4 T cells. And this then leads to an autoantigen specific response. But these autoantigens might be different between different patients, and it might not be one single antigen, and therefore the search for it is quite complicated. So to summarize, the immune response in MS is initiated in the periphery in lymphoid organs, where autoantigens are presented by B cells and dendritic cells to T cells. The T cells interact with the B cells and they activate each other and lead to a maturation and proliferation of B cells. Then these cells circulate through the body, search the antigen. Since they have been activated, they can cross the blood-brain barrier, get into these perivascular cuffs. There they can get reactivated and then finally enter into the brain parenchyma. And there together, CD8 T cells, CD4 T cells, and B cells produce cytokines, which leads to infiltration of even more immune cells into the brain and leads to activation of resident microglia. And the factors produced by these immune cells finally lead also to the destruction of myelin and neurons. And there, probably important antibodies recognize antigens and activate complement. But there's also probably direct damage by CD8 T cells against neurons and oligodendrocytes. So in this next section, I will talk about pathogenic mechanisms as therapeutic targets. The first treatments that were introduced in multiple sclerosis were interferon beta and clotrimer acetate GA. Interferon beta was initially thought to be an antiviral drug because it was thought that MS is initiated by a viral infection and therefore an antiviral treatment might really benefit. Interferons worked, but probably via different action. So interferons lead to a change of the cytokine profile of the T cells and B cells. So normally in MS, there's a Th1 profile. And this Th1 profile is characterized by interferon gamma production and TNF-alpha, so two pro-inflammatory cytokines. With the treatment of interferon beta, the cytokine profile is changed from this pro-inflammatory type to Th2 type, which is characterized by IL-4, IL-5, IL-9, and IL-13 production. Clotrimer acetate is a polypeptide with different amino acids, and this has been initially discovered as a compound that should induce MS in the animal model. But then it was seen that it's really improving the animal model, so it's protecting the animals from the disease. And it probably has a similar mode of action, changing the cytokine profile of immune cells, and maybe also affecting the antigen-presenting cells, like dendritic cells, so their profile also is changed towards an anti-inflammatory profile of cytokines. The next drug I want to talk about is dimethyl fumarate. Dimethyl fumarate is an old drug that has been a long time ago already used for treatment of psoriasis. And patients that had both psoriasis and multiple sclerosis realized that their MS was also getting better with DMF treatment. And they told their doctors, and then a trial was run, phase 2 trial, phase 3 trial, really showing a high efficacy of DMF also in multiple sclerosis. The mode of action is really not completely understood. There might be NRF2-dependent pathways and NRF2-independent pathways. So the NRF2-dependent pathways lead to neuroprotection and a protective milieu in the CNS that might also protect oligodendrocytes and promote anti-inflammatory microglia. A main action of the drug that we see in the blood is a reduction of pro-inflammatory lymphocytes, T lymphocytes that produce cytokines like GM-CSF, interferon gamma, TNF-alpha, and IL-2. How this reduction is really done by this treatment is not really known. The next group of drugs I want to talk about are the S1P receptor modulators. So the first drug in this group was fingolimod. It binds to 4 out of 5 S1P receptors. The most important binding is against the S1P receptor 1. This receptor is responsible for the egress of lymphocytes, so T cells and B cells, from the lymph node into the blood. The receptor is needed that the immune cells find a gradient of sphingosine in the lymph nodes and thereby can exit the lymph node. If S1P receptor modulators bind to the receptor is internalized, and therefore the lymphocytes lose their guiding signal out of the lymph node. And this, of course, leads to a strong reduction of lymphocytes in the blood, so they drop by 60 to 80%. And if they cannot enter the bloodstream anymore, they can, of course, also not go into the brain and cause inflammation there. Another migration inhibitor drug is natalizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody directed against the alpha-4 integrin. Alpha-4 integrin is a main molecule at the level of the membrane of lymphocytes that binds to VCAM1, and this is essential for the adherence of lymphocytes to endothelial cells and finally for the migration of the lymphocytes through the blood-brain barrier into the CNS. So when you treat patients with natalizumab, you see an increase of lymphocytes in the blood because they cannot exit the blood vessels anymore as good as before. And of course, this leads to a dramatic reduction of inflammation in the brain, because if the T and B cells cannot go into the brain, all the subsequent cascade is blocked. Clatrubine is one example for a depleting drug. It's a nucleoside analogon. It's taken up by many cells, and the drug is resistant to degradation by ADA, so it accumulates in the cells. It then can get activated by kinases and deactivated by phosphatases. The ratio between kinase and phosphatase indicates how much accumulates in the cell. So the more kinase activation is there and the less phosphatase activation, the more accumulation of the drug you have in the cell. And since this ratio is different in different cell types, you get a predilection of the treatment effect in B and T lymphocytes. So the drug is an anti-proliferative drug, but it mainly acts in B and T lymphocytes. When you look at the lymphocyte kinetics after one cycle of clatrubine treatment, you see a quite dramatic decrease of lymphocytes, but you also see that the impact is different in T cells and B cells. So B cells are mainly affected and go down more compared to the decrease of T lymphocytes. You can also see that the recovery of cells is different, with a more pronounced recovery of naive B cells and a quite long-lasting depletion or reduction of memory B cells, really indicating that the drug not only has a preferred target of lymphocytes, but in the end, a preferred target probably of memory B cells that stay down for a very long time. And then we come to a monoclonal antibody group that really directs the B cells. That's the CD20 monoclonal antibodies that are directed against the CD20 molecule, which is expressed exclusively by B cells. Antibodies like ocrelizumab, which is given intravenously every 6 months, or ofatumumab, which is given subcutaneously every month, bind to the CD20 molecule, activate complement cascade or Fc receptor mechanisms, and thereby lead to the destruction of B cells. When you treat patients, you see a complete depletion of these B cells in the blood for a very long time. So it goes in the blood really down to zero for a very long time, and they come up only a little bit just before the next infusion and are depleted again. So a very effective B cell depleter, comparable to clatrubine, but even more extended in its effect. And last but not least, I want to introduce teriflunomide, which is also an anti-proliferative drug. It inhibits an enzyme that is needed for the de novo pyrimidine synthesis and therefore acts in activated T and B cells. So if T and B cells are activated, they will proliferate. And for this proliferation, they need pyrimidine. And this drug inhibits an enzyme that is needed for this pyrimidine neosynthesis and therefore blocks the activation-induced proliferation of T and B cells. It's not specific for MS because the predecessor of this drug, leflunomide, also works in rheumatoid arthritis. So we often use this drug in clinical practice in patients that have both MS and rheumatoid arthritis, where you can think that the drug would work for both diseases. So to summarize, the treatment landscape in MS has really started with interferons and clatrimer acetate, which are called immunomodulators because they shift the cytokine profile from a Th1 to a Th2 phenotype, changing from interferon gamma, TNF-alpha, to IL-4, IL-5. Then there's dimethyl fumarate, where we don't really exactly know the mode of action, but it certainly has an impact on pro-inflammatory lymphocytes that are reduced by the drug in the blood. Then there's this group of immune cell migration inhibitors. One group is the S1P receptor modulators like fingolimod, siponimod, ozanimod, ponesimod. So many of them are now on the market. They act on different receptors, and the binding leads to a reduction of surface expression of the S1P receptor 1, And this is important for lymphocyte egress, and therefore it inhibits infiltration of immune cells into the brain. The other migration inhibitor is natalizumab. It blocks the immune cells directly at the blood-brain barrier, where it blocks VLA4 on the lymphocyte, which is needed for the lymphocyte to adhere to the endothelium and for the egress of lymphocytes from the bloodstream into the CNS. And there's this group of cell-depleting therapies. Clatribine is given in cycles as tablets, and it interferes with the DNA synthesis and leads to an apoptosis of immune cells. It's quite specific for lymphocytes because of the ratio of kinase and phosphatase that activate the drug. Interestingly, it's even more specific, not only on lymphocytes, but looking at the kinetics, it really mainly impacts memory B cells in the long term. And then there are the specific anti-CD20 antibodies that really deplete specifically CD20 expressing B cells, very long lasting. And finally, there's teriflunomide that inhibits the pyrimidine neosynthesis and therefore blocks the proliferation of activated T and B cells, and which leads again to a reduced inflammation in the brain, reduced relapses, and reduced T2 lesions. So in the next section, I want to talk about a new therapeutic target. That's the Bruton's tyrosine kinase. Bruton's tyrosine kinase is an important enzyme in the activation of B cells. So once a B cell recognizes its target antigen via the B cell receptor, there's a cascade initiated inside the cell of the B cell. And in this cascade, BTK is activated and leads to downstream activation of the B cell, which in the end leads to antibody production, maturation, cytokine production, and proliferation of the B cell. If the BTK is inhibited, these inflammatory effects are reduced in the B cells. Importantly, the BTK inhibition does not only work in B cells, but also works in myeloid cells, so in the innate immune system. Myeloid cells express an Fc receptor. Fc receptors are receptors that recognizes antibody-antigen complexes. So once an antibody binds to an antigen, it can then bind to an Fc receptor and activate thereby the myeloid cell. And the intracellular signaling is again mediated by BTK and can be inhibited by these BTK inhibitors. And therefore, this leads to a reduced inflammation of the innate immune response. So that's an important novel principle that a drug in MS can not only target the adaptive immune system, in this case the B cell, but also the innate immune system, so myeloid cells, macrophages, microglia. Another important point is that BTK inhibitors could go into the CNS and thereby impact the immune response directly in the CNS, B cells, but also microglia and macrophages. And this is essentially an important point that might play a role in progressive MS, where you have a compartmentalized inflammation. So there's not much influx of immune cells from the periphery into the brain anymore, but there's really residential inflammation going on in the brain. And thereby our current drugs that mainly work in the periphery, an example is natalizumab, a monoclonal antibody that blocks migration of immune cells into the CNS, does not really work in the progressive phase. So one really needs drugs that can go into the CNS in this stage and impact the immune response locally in the brain. And BTK inhibitors might be one of those drugs. So currently different BTK inhibitors are in clinical development. That's evobrutinib, tolebrutinib, orelabrutinib, and fenebrutinib. They all differ in their IC50. They differ in how they bind to the tyrosine kinases. So some are covalently bound, meaning it's an irreversible binding. So once they engage with a kinase, they do not go off anymore. And others, like fenebrutinib, are non-covalently bound, so the interaction with the kinase is reversible. Then the selectivity is different, so some of the drugs are very specific for the Bruton's tyrosine kinase, and others bind also other tyrosine kinases, maybe impacting also then other immune cell subtypes, which might be beneficial, of course, if they better target macrophages, dendritic cells, and so on. But could also lead to some more side effects or different side effects. And of course, they might differ in their CNS permeability. And as told you before, that would be one interesting mode of action, that these drugs can go into the CNS and impact the immune response directly in the CNS, which many of our drugs, namely the monoclonal antibodies, cannot. So the first drug that I want you to present you is evobrutinib, the phase 2 trial of this drug. The primary endpoint of the trial was gut-enhancing lesions. Phase 2 trials are always quite short, so this trial was 6 months long, and the number of patients is quite small. In this trial, patients have been randomized to 5 groups: evobrutinib 25 mg once daily, evobrutinib 75 mg once daily, 75 mg twice daily, placebo, and DMF as a comparator group. And here you can see the primary endpoint, that's the gut-enhancing lesions. You see that with increasing the dose of evobrutinib, you see a decrease of gut-enhancing lesions, showing that the drug has an impact on probably relapses, but at least on MRI activity, on the gut-enhancing lesions. DMF in this trial was similar to the placebo group, which is probably due to the low number of patients analyzed and also the short length of the trial. The other outcome, secondary outcomes, EDSS and annualized relapse rate are often negative in phase 2 trials because, as I said, groups are small, the treatment duration is short, and often the drugs need a longer time to really become fully effective. Gut-enhancing lesions is the most sensitive marker we have in phase 2 trials, therefore it's always used. But to show a clinical efficacy, of course, a phase 3 trial has to be done, which runs for a longer time, mainly more or at least 2 years, and recruits a lot more patients than a phase 2 trial. So these are the side effects of the evobrutinib phase 2 trial. Not much to say. There was a little bit of liver enzyme increases, nasopharyngitis, and flushing in the DMF group, which is expected because it's a known side effect of DMF. But as I said before, of course, you have to see in phase 3 trials, longer duration, more patients, if there are relevant rare side effects emerging. The second drug I want to introduce is tolebrutinib, another BTK inhibitor. This drug was tested in a phase 2b trial that lasted only 16 weeks, so even shorter than the trial I showed before, and it has a very specific or peculiar trial design. So first, patients were randomized in 2 cohorts. Cohort 1, patients received tolebrutinib for 12 weeks, which was followed then by 4 weeks of placebo treatment. In cohort 2, patients received first 4 weeks of placebo treatment and then received 12 weeks of the real treatment, tolebrutinib. And in both cohorts, patients were then randomized again to 4 dose groups, so tolebrutinib 5 mg, 15, 30, and 60 mg. And the primary endpoint, again, was the gut-enhancing lesions. And as before, with evobrutinib, you see a nice dose-dependent decrease, with the most prominent effect on gut-enhancing lesions in the tolebrutinib 60 mg dosage. Again, indicating that there's an impact on the inflammation in the brain and the blood-brain barrier disruption, and indicating also a clinical efficacy. And as with evobrutinib, the side effect profile was quite good. There was some cases of headache, back pain, upper respiratory tract infection, but also, again, like I said, with evobrutinib, it needs a longer trial. And the phase 3 trials are again ongoing, recruiting patients and comparing tolebrutinib against teriflunomide in relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. But these are not the only ones. Fenebrutinib is another drug that is currently tested in phase 3 trials. 2 trials running in relapsing remitting MS against teriflunomide, and 1 trial in primary progressive MS testing fenebrutinib against ocrelizumab. And as I said in the beginning, I think it's very important that trials are done in progressive MS, because so far our treatments in progressive MS are not very effective. Ocrelizumab showed some response in PPMS, and siponimod showed some response in SPMS, but the treatment effect was really small. So it's very important to find new, more effective treatments. And the BTK inhibitors might play an important role, because they could target, theoretically, the compartmentalized inflammation in the brain affecting the innate immune cells and the adaptive immune cells in the CNS. So other BDK inhibitors that are tested are remibrutinib, that's tested versus teriflunomide, and orelabrutinib against placebo in a phase 2 trial, all in relapsing remitting MS. So taking together, BDK inhibitors are a really novel mode of action in multiple sclerosis, acting on B cells, but also on innate immune cells, acting in the periphery, and probably some of the compounds also in the CNS directly. Currently, we have phase 2 results of evobrutinib and tolebrutinib that both showed positive outcomes in the primary endpoint, which are GAD-enhancing lesions. And currently, a lot of drugs are in phase 2 and 3 trials, so fenebrutinib, remibrutinib, tolebrutinib, and evobrutinib are in phase 3, and orelabrutinib is in phase 2 trials currently going on. And it's really expected that in 2 to 3 years, we have the results of these phase 3 trials, and I'm positive and confident that for sure we will see positive results for relapsing remitting MS, because we can really extrapolate from the phase 2 GAD-enhancing lesion result to the phase 3 trials. So far, this always worked. If you see an effect in the phase 2, you will see some effect in the relapsing remitting stage. For progressive MS, it's less clear, but equally or even more important that the trials are done, because there are not so many choices for the patients with progressive MS. With this, I thank you, and I hope you could learn something.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchneurology.com.